Great. So we're going to switch gears. We're going to talk about some things with eyes and look at some effects from diabetic retinopathy. My name is Steve Mansberger. I'm an ophthalmologist from Devers Eye Institute in Portland, Oregon at OHSU in Portland, Oregon. And we're going to talk about the Northwest Tribal Vision Project, which is looking at the comparative effectiveness of telemedicine for detecting diabetic retinopathy. These are my disclosures. I'm a glaucoma specialist as well. They all have relation to glaucoma, not diabetes, and really nothing related to this talk. So what I'm going to talk to you a little bit about was common eye diseases in American Indians and some results. Our current CER project, some results, what our dissemination has been so far, and some future directions. So there's many different types of people here in the room. There's probably biostatisticians, there's probably some epidemiologists, maybe there's an eye care provider in the room. But I thought I would just give a little bit of anatomy just to kind of orient you to what we're talking about with eyes. And this is just a video, hopefully it'll play. And there's fluid that's made here in the ciliary body, and then it travels out through here. This is called the lens. This is what develops into a cataract. When you have multiple different layers, it becomes yellow, and it prevents light from getting back here to the retina. This structure here, this white structure entering into the eye, is called the optic nerve. This is what's affected by glaucoma. These are blood vessels here traveling out from the optic nerve. This is what's affected by diabetes. And diabetes will basically affect all parts of the eyes that has vasculature. And if you have severe diabetes, you'll actually get blood vessels growing in front of the eye, causing elevated pressure and causing glaucoma. Let me go to the next. So this is just a boring schematic of the same thing, but cataract occurs here, diabetes occurs in all parts of the eye, macular degeneration occurs back here in the retina, and then glaucoma affects the optic nerve. And so mainly for this presentation, talking about diabetes, and there's two main ways that people lose vision from diabetes. This first one here is called macular edema. And what you can see here is some yellow. This is a normal view. I think this is actually my eye. And there's a normal view. I hope my eye is normal. And then there's you can see these yellow exudates here. You can see these little areas of hemorrhage. And these are signs that the blood vessels have become leaky. They get coated with sugar, and these blood vessels just leak. And this picture down here in the bottom right is a picture of somebody with proliferative diabetic retinopathy. And what you can see is you can see these blood vessels are growing off of a normal blood vessel. Here you get all these arborization, look like leaves of a tree. And these blood vessels break easily and bleed. And so if you have a patient who has diabetes that loses vision like that, it's usually from this proliferative diabetic retinopathy, where if somebody loses vision slowly, it's usually from this macular edema. Well, why do we want to do CER in diabetic retinopathy? Well, it's the leading cause of blindness in working age adults, and it disproportionately affects American Indians and Alaska Natives. And if you look at studies, it's about four times the prevalence in American Indians and other minorities versus whites. American Indians and Alaska Natives, as well as other minorities, have greater difficulty with transportation, ability to access eye care providers. They have troubles with copays and other costs, and lack of health insurance. So if you can design some way to facilitate access for these groups, it would help them to get these eye exams. We know that laser treatment of diabetic retinopathy results in a tenfold reduction in vision loss from proliferative diabetic retinopathy and a threefold reduction from this macular edema. And we know that diabetic eye exams, just early treatment, would save about almost a half a billion dollars. So why CER and telemedicine? There's been the previous studies have poor research designs, at least no randomized controlled trials, no long-term follow-up, no evaluation of cost-effectiveness, no adoptable telemedicine system, and I'll get into that in just a second, and no estimation of the health behavior for annual eye exams. So this is one of the tools we've implicated or we've used for telemedicine. This is called a non-midriatic camera. Non-midriatic means without dilation, and the patient would put their head here into this kind of head holder. The operator would operate the machine here, push a button on top, and it would take a picture. These are digitally stored, and you can send them digitally. Well, there's two topics that we cover with our CER project. The first quartile priority topic is compare the effectiveness of interventions to reduce health disparities in cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, et cetera. The second one is a second quartile priority topic. This is from the Institute of Medicine. Is compare the effectiveness of new remote monitoring and management technologies such as telemedicine. You know, we think, and I think the government thinks that telemedicine is a better, you know, in some ways a good way, a cost-effective way of providing care, especially to areas where it's, you know, rural and low-access settings. So we used Danielle at the very beginning mentioned some of the difficulties with doing a randomized controlled trial where you don't give any intervention to a group. Well, you can imagine the difficulty of having a new, a new technique for detecting diabetic retinopathy, not offering it to American Indians and other minorities, how they may not want to participate in that trial, and they may just want to participate in only the new technique. So what we did is we did this staged intervention where we randomized them to either the telemedicine group or the traditional provider group, but we did a staged intervention. So after 2 years, they all would be offered the telemedicine technology. This has a lot of advantages from a statistics standpoint, and the last speaker talked about this a little bit as well. You can also compare your different groups in lots of different ways. So there's a lot of advantages to this. I want to also mention that the diabetic patients would see their medical doctor. The medical doctor would continue to say that you need to see your eye care provider. So even though they may be in the telemedicine group, they didn't tell them they didn't need to go see their eye care provider. Everybody was told they need to see their eye care provider because we weren't really able to say that we can replace an eye care exam with telemedicine. And we had two locations, both with a high proportion of American Indians, both with access issues to getting eye exams. And this was in Umatilla in Pendleton, Oregon, and Hunter Health Clinic in Wichita, Kansas. Well, I kind of talked about no adaptable telemedicine system. Well, we naively started this project and thought, we can just borrow software from the web or borrow software from other places that have been doing it. And I asked around and we couldn't find anybody who would either let us borrow software or the software to work. So we ended up building our own software to transfer the images. And one of our programmers worked at NASA and was in charge of sending images from the space station from satellites back to here. And so he had the expertise to kind of develop this system. And we developed the system. It's called Software as a Service. It's a software that exists completely on the web, so it doesn't exist on your desktop. You can access it only needing a web browser, and it costs about 10 to 20% of the cost of traditional software and service. And this is a Wall Street Journal article. It's not about our software, but it came out about the same time that we developed ours. This is just kind of a movie or a new telemedicine client. And what it does is you can you just push this button. This patient has already been imaged. I've sped this up twice so you guys didn't have to watch the whole thing. But it takes about 2 minutes to upload everything. You just put in their ID. This goes to the computer and figures out what images they've had. And then you have this program here where you just drag and drop it into the different locations. This is really nice for when you have, you know, a front desk person doing your imaging. Someone who doesn't know a lot about eyes, they can easily learn this program. It's just like your iPhone app. You just basically download it. We can adjust it on the fly. Our programmer, again, this guy from NASA, he's figured out a way of making the computer just look at the photos and tell which location it should go to. And so his next iteration of this program is actually to load them into the locations in which he thinks they should occur, and then you just push approve. It digitizes, it scrambles, it compresses, and then sends the images. And so we're able to now send about 12 images very, very quickly in under 30 seconds. So it really is making it smooth for our spoke locations to send the images to us. This is just a picture of the database, and they can access the database to know that this stuff has been received. And this is going to be actually changed here relatively soon, but this is a report generation. It automatically, after I read these photos, it automatically populates this report, and this report gets sent back to the tribes. It can be automatically integrated into their electronic medical record, and we can fax it or email it. So that's a little bit of background about the study. I'll just talk a little bit more if you're about some of the things that we did. We took two photos of the optic nerve. That's the photo on the right to look for glaucoma. We took two photos in the photo in the center there to look for macular edema. And then we took one photo superior temporal and one inferior temporal to look for diabetic retinopathy. These set of six photos have shown to be highly predictive for levels of diabetic retinopathy. This is just a staging system that we use. We go from stage 0 to stage 4, and I'll go a little bit more into this in just a second. But stage 0 and 1, 0 is no abnormalities. Stage 1 is mild proliferative diabetic retinopathy. Moderate is stage 2, and the reason I kind of use that one is because when they have more than moderate, where they have severe or proliferative diabetic retinopathy, then they may require treatment. If they got macular edema, they may require treatment. So this is just some pictures. I'll go back here. So this is just a mild proliferative diabetic retinopathy. This is severe. You get all these multiple hemorrhages all over the place. And then this is proliferative diabetic retinopathy, these blood vessels and blood vessels growing on the optic nerve. So we have 567 diabetic participants. We have 296 in the camera group and 271 in the provider group. And the levels of diabetes, they had relatively severe diabetes with hemoglobin A1C of 8.3, recommended is less than 7, and they had a diabetes for a mean time of about 10 years. The reason this is important is severity of diabetes and length of diabetes are highly associated with levels of diabetic retinopathy. Their age range was very similar to what we see with diabetics of about 55 years. And about half male and half female. So was there a recruitment bias? You know, with many randomized controlled trials, we recruit the healthiest people out of the clinic. And so we looked at that. Out of the clinical population that was approached, we excluded about 79 because they refused participation or they weren't eligible. And then we randomized the rest. And so of those that we approached but didn't randomize, there was no difference in age, there was no difference in duration of diabetes or hemoglobin A1C, but there was a difference in gender. And we were more likely to enroll people if they were women. And that's been shown in lots of different studies. Women are better about preventative health practices than men. And it may just be that they're induced or they're recruited into preventative health practices much earlier. I mean, I'll get my first colonoscopy when I'm 50. Women have been getting preventative health measures for cervical cancer since they're in their teens. So it may just be something related to that, but that's very common in other studies. So one of the baseline results is just what's the proportion of people that got an eye exam. And with the telemedicine group, 94% had baseline images evaluated. So 94% of them had exams, and only in the provider group, only 55% had a baseline exam. So telemedicine had a huge improvement in the proportion of screening exams. Was there a bias for attaining exam? Maybe for some reason, those that actually went and got exams, were older or younger or whatever. So we looked at whether or not there was any type of difference for attaining exam. Any type of exam, and there was no difference in age, gender, ethnicity, blood pressure, hemoglobin A1C, duration of diabetes, although diastolic blood pressure was slightly different, and we just think this is an anomaly. So one of the big things about a screening study is if you have to screen all these people and everybody needs to go see an ophthalmologist anyway, then you're not saving any money, you're not saving any time. You're basically just adding a test to them that's not useful. In contrast, though, if you do a screening and almost everybody doesn't need to see the eye care provider, then you're actually saving these people a lot of time and money, because if you're telling them they all need to go see an eye care provider every day, but then you do the screening and show that a huge proportion doesn't, then you could save them a lot of time and money. And so we do use several different cutoffs for what would be a criteria for going to see an ophthalmologist. And if you use a cutoff where I'm showing here of moderate non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy or worse, about 92% of people had levels of diabetic retinopathy not requiring them to see an eye care provider. So that's pretty good. 90% didn't have levels of diabetic retinopathy. But if you used other definitions for a triage screen, you'd find that 7% as I mentioned, would be screened if, or would need to see an eye care provider based on moderate diabetic retinopathy. If you added in macular edema or unable to determine, it goes to about 19%. And if you add all of those criteria and also glaucoma, then it goes to about 26%. But even with that level, there still is about 3/4 of participants that don't have levels of diabetic retinopathy or levels of eye disease requiring them to see an eye care provider. What were some issues? Well, I think unable to determine, just not getting a good image with telemedicine with these non-mydriatic cameras is something that many people have seen in the past. And what we found was about 16% of people were unable to view. And so if you think about that 26% using this, you know, the strictest definition, over half of them were just because of unable to determine. Hopefully, at some point, we have some expertise in laser-based imaging, and laser-based imaging is able to view the retina even with cataracts, small pupils, etc. And there may be some instruments in the future that will be able to image and get this proportion down even further. What were the risk factors for diabetic retinopathy? And this is important if you were planning on bringing telemedicine to your clinic. Let's say that you had lots of differences in our clinic population, then maybe you would have higher rates of diabetic retinopathy or lower rates of diabetic retinopathy. So we found that higher systolic blood pressure, higher hemoglobin A1C, longer duration of diabetes, and non-white primary ethnicity were all associated with risk factors for diabetic retinopathy. So future manuscripts, we're going to be looking at long-term comparative effectiveness. We're actually going to be running the data here relatively soon. We're going to look at incidence and risk factors for progression of diabetic retinopathy. That's important. If people are going from stage 0 to stage 3 relatively quickly, then that means that maybe that your screening protocol wouldn't be as valuable because everybody's going to reach a treatable component pretty quickly. So we're going to look at progression of diabetic retinopathy. We're going to look at health behavior factors. Even though you may have this telemedicine unit, it's very accessible, it's free. Maybe there's some factors why people won't still want to utilize it. And so we're going to look at some health behavior factors related to that. And finally, we're going to look at some cost effectiveness using actual patient data. This is just our duration of follow-up so far. This is actually just from February, so we have a lot longer follow-up now. And as far as progression, we had about 83% had no change in diabetic retinopathy. So that's a good sign that these patients are relatively stable in their diabetic retinopathy. As far as dissemination, we were really pleased that, I never really realized the value of dissemination until these articles came out. But a reporter from the Oregonian heard about our project and wrote an article. And we had, 20 to 30 calls from different clinics wanting to use the technology and see how they can be involved. And it turned out it was the Oregonian Article of the Year for 2010. As far as dissemination, we know that diabetes is going to increase from 23 million to over 44 million by 2034. You know, most patients need to have eye exams, and it's a leading cause of blindness. So we're hoping that this could be a new paradigm for detecting diabetic retinopathy, where you first triage with telemedicine and then use follow-up exams if needed. And this goes with the primary care medical home model. So we have a clinical pilot testing now in a clinic across the street, which had 70% annual eye exams. Should be 90, and so they're right across the street from our clinic, and we started with them, and they have the opportunity to go to about 10 clinics. So in summary, most participants did not have levels of diabetic retinopathy requiring an eye exam. Progression of diabetic retinopathy was low at 12%, and telemedicine with non-mydriatic cameras may increase access and decrease costs for diabetic eye exams. So these are some publications. I want to thank our funders and all the people that have helped put this project together. Thank you. Thank you.